to Valerie Jarrett, because what it signals is a broader understanding that Democrats and Democratic values are the only way for progress in America.
Stacey Abrams, I'd like to ask you to stay so we can do a post-show interview, and we'll post online under WEG exclusive. Stacey Abrams is Democratic candidate for governor in Georgia. Her new book, Minority Leader, How to Lead from the Outside and Make Real Change. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Accepting applications for our paid video production fellowships. Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Don't worry. I won't hurt you. I only want you to have some fun.
Dearly beloved,
oh yeah, come ride and dance with Diablo all over Portland as we celebrate Prince's birthday on Thursday, June 7th at 8 p.m. with a mobile bicycle dance party. We'll be rocking Pedalpalooza and dropping the Prince jams all night long with frequent dance stops. Once again, that's Prince's birthday bike ride celebration, Thursday, June 7th at 8 p.m. More information on the KBOO website under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Northwest Deaf Arts Festival on Saturday, June 16th at Mississippi Studios in Portland. The Northwest Deaf Arts Festival consists of a family-friendly matinee show as well as an adult-only 21 and over evening show. Performers include hip-hop artist Sean Forbes, dancer Antoine Hunter, poet Raymond Luzak, and more. Again, that's the Northwest Deaf Arts Festival on Saturday, June 16th at 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. Mississippi Studios is located at 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is hiring an archive contractor for 40 hours a week for $20 an hour. This is a contract position that will last from July through December of 2018. The archive contractor will steward the KBOO archival assets in all forms. They will work with historical KBOO content in many audio formats, as well as the Resource Space Archival Database, documents of KBOO history, and KBOO staff and volunteers. Please send in a resume, cover letter, and answer the question, why is KBOO important, to Del at kboo.org. That's D-E-L at kboo.org. More information about responsibilities and position requirements can be found at kboo.fm.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, there's an upcoming rally for a rezoning mobile home parks here in Portland.
We hear about Trump's immigration policy.
And we'll get an update on water safety for residents in the Salem area.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 4th, 2018. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. According to the Oregonian, Wilsonville's tap water has now been declared safe for residents to drink. On Friday, city officials released a warning that tap water contained trace amounts of cyanotoxins. The cyanotoxins were released by blue-green algae, which was discovered in the city's water source. Test results published today noted that no drinking water from the city's facility was found to contain microcystins, a cyanosin dangerous to humans and animals. Last week, officials in Salem released a water advisory recommending children under six, senior citizens, people with immune diseases, and pets all avoid drinking tap water. This advisory caused a water run which cleared out local stores of bottled water. Governor Kate Brown declared a state of emergency, allowing Oregon National Guard to bring in trucks of drinking water to the affected areas. Officials followed EPA guidelines, which state that vulnerable groups are not at risk until they have consumed contaminated tap water for 10 days. Officials did not release the water advisory until 4 days after the first detecting the toxins, and have since come under fire for waiting to announce the issue to the public. On Saturday, the city announced that tap water was safe to drink in Marion and Polk counties, where the advisory was in effect. Wilsonville's treatment plant, which was rebuilt in 2014, has an ozonation system which kills microorganisms and degrades cyanotoxins and other organic pollutants in the water. The city water will be continuously tested for 7 days to ensure that the level of toxins in the water does not become dangerous again.
Following our coverage last week on police conduct, Oregon police are now under renewed scrutiny. This morning, KGW published a video of a violent arrest captured by one of its photographers. The photographer was positioned outside of a search and rescue command center in Marion County. The search and rescue center is dedicated to finding a missing father and son. Deputies arrested a man who the Marion County Sheriff's Office describes as, quote, a transient who repeatedly entered the command post communication area and was making so much noise the search team couldn't even hear communication with the field crews. Captured in the video of the arrest, four deputies force the man to the ground, while one deputy punches the man in the back of the head. The deputy punches the man 15 times as the man repeatedly yells that he's not resisting. After the 15th and final punch, one of the deputies can be heard threatening the man, saying, "You're gonna get tased." ACLU of Oregon Executive Director David Rogers has called on the district attorney to investigate the use of force during the arrest. Rogers released a statement saying, "That video is disturbing. It's violent. Honestly, if that does not represent excessive use of force, I'm not quite sure what does." The man was charged by deputies with interference. Ethan Griffith, a Marion County Sheriff's deputy, says that the Sheriff's Office sent a mental health team to the scene following the arrest to attempt to help the man. It's still unclear if the district attorney or the Marion County Sheriff's Office will investigate the deputy in question.
On June 12th at the Southeast Portland Community College campus on Southeast 82nd Avenue and Southeast Division, there will be a rally for a new zoning proposal for mobile home parks in the city of Portland. For more on this, we spoke with Cameron Harrington of the Living Collie Association. Could you tell us a bit about this event that you all are having at the and where it's at, what time?
So the Portland Planning and Sustainability Commission will be holding a public hearing and a vote on this zone change proposal. That's going to be next Tuesday, June 12th, in the evening. We will be rallying outside of the meeting at 6 p.m. And then going into the meeting, which is at 6:30. And this is all happening at the Portland Community College Southeast campus on 82nd Avenue and Southeast Division. And again, it's the hearing starts at 6:30 p.m. on June 12th at PCC Southeast, but we will be rallying outside with mobile home residents and supporters starting at 6 o'clock. It's a hearing of the Planning and Sustainability Commission. And it is, they will be voting on a proposal to create the state of Oregon's first dedicated zoning designation specifically for manufactured housing parks. And the proposal would apply to 56 manufactured housing parks across the city of Portland, which combined are home to over 3,000 households. And the purpose of the zone change is to designate a manufactured housing park as the only allowed use of those properties.
Could you tell me a little bit about what's the difference between living in a, as far as rights go, living in a mobile home as opposed to a house that is not mobile? Are these people more vulnerable than other populations?
Well, if you live in a manufactured home park, most residents own their own home, the structure, but they do not own the land that it's on. So they're paying a monthly space rent to the owner of the park. And this does make residents vulnerable to losing their homes in a couple of different ways. First is similar to anyone else who's renting, which is that they can be displaced by a rent increase that they can't afford. The second way is particular to a mobile home park, and that is if the entire park is shut down in order to be redeveloped for another use. And that's what this zoning proposal is really aimed at preventing.
And then whenever people do lose their the land that their homes are on, what often happens to their trailers? Are they easy to move, or is there anywhere else they can move them?
It's very unlikely that someone living in a manufactured housing park would be able to actually move their home in the event that a park was shut down. And that's for two different reasons. First, there are not very many available spaces in other mobile home parks that the home could be moved to. But even if there was a place to move it, most of the homes are old and of such age and condition that it's nearly impossible to move them. And doing so would be prohibitively expensive, but in a lot of cases, no company would even agree to move a home that is of a certain age, because it's just unlikely that it survived the move. Mm-hmm. So even though you'll hear the term mobile home, for the most part, the only time that these homes are mobile is the first time that they're moved into the location where they're set up. And after that, they're really rather immobile.
Would you say that people who live in mobile homes and then have their land sold out from underneath them, quite literally, are more at a risk of becoming houseless in the future?
Well, folks who live in manufactured housing parks are very low income for the most part. This is housing that is the most affordable, non-subsidized housing in the city. And so this is really the only option that most residents have to afford housing anywhere close to the city of Portland, let alone in the city itself. So having a park shut down would really place a lot of residents at risk of becoming homeless, simply because there's nothing else that they can afford on their incomes.
And so presently, people that are living in mobile parks that are quite self-sufficient, would you say that kicking them off their property would basically be more of a burden on the city?
Yeah, having manufactured housing parks redeveloped and the current residents displaced from their homes would really be counterproductive to Portland's goals around decreasing homelessness, preventing displacement, and preserving affordable housing. The parks are really tight-knit communities internally, with folks providing a lot of caring and support for one another, helping to take care of each other's kids, providing rides to the store and to the doctor. And so these networks of mutual support that are very strong within manufactured housing parks, those would also be destroyed by the redevelopment.
So they wouldn't just be losing housing equity, they'd also be losing basically social equity that's found in tight-knit neighborhoods.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, do you know anything about historical precedents with kind of mobile homes, parks, autonomy, or other laws that have been passed like this anywhere in the United States?
There are a number of jurisdictions around the country that mm-hmm. have used this same zoning strategy to preserve manufactured housing parks. Mm-hmm. Those include places like Albuquerque, Boulder, Colorado, and even a couple in Washington State, Snohomish County, and the city of Tumwater, Washington. But Portland will be the first jurisdiction in the state of Oregon to preserve manufactured housing parks with this zoning strategy.
I really admire the organization that you work for. It seems like you guys work for, I think of it as like an economically integrated community. That's, it seems like we're seeing less and less of that in Portland. Do you see the importance of having just low-income housing within a city center? And what would Portland lose if we were to keep pushing people out?
Well, we're working alongside low-income people who live in the Cully neighborhood, mm-hmm. who are fighting to preserve their homes here. And that's what's led us to be working for this manufactured housing preservation mm-hmm. policy, because there are 6 mobile home parks here in the Cully neighborhood that are home to well over 1,000 people. And so this is really an essential part of what it means to prevent and to preserve a place for low-income people in the city. We're really pleased that a number of homeowners and people of higher income levels have also supported this measure and have come forward and said it's important to them that Cully remain a diverse neighborhood racially and economically. The Cully Neighborhood Association voted to support this zoning proposal. So, it's very important to maintain places that will be permanently available for low-income people to have stable, affordable homes.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, that's about all the time we have, Cameron. That was Cameron Harrington from Living Cully Association speaking with us about an upcoming rally for the rezoning of mobile home parks in Portland that will be held at PCC's Southeast Campus at 6 p.m. next Tuesday, June 12th.
The Black History Podcast highlights African American history for every day of the year. On today's episode, Donna Summers.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is June 4th. And on this day, in 1983, She Works Hard for the Money, performed by the queen of disco, Donna Summer, became the number one R&B song. Inspired by Onetta Johnson, a bathroom attendant that fell asleep while working at a party Miss Summer attended, the women's national anthem celebrated everyday people.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365. Bam! 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
Climate Connections is a daily podcast focused on how climate change affects our daily lives and what we can do about it. Today we hear about bird species moving higher up in the mountains to find more suitable climates.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The spruce forests of New York's Whiteface Mountain are home to dozens of bird species, including yellow-bellied flycatchers, blackpoll warblers, and purple finches. Many of these birds have been moving uphill. Ornithologist Jeremy Kirkman is curator of birds at the New York State Museum. He recently repeated a bird survey that was conducted on the mountain 40 years ago.
What we found is that the majority of species, more than half, had shifted their ranges uphill.
The elevation where each species is most abundant, on average, is about 270 feet higher.
We hypothesize that that's in response to the warming climate.
Average daily high temperatures on the mountain have increased more than 3 degrees Fahrenheit over the past 40 years. Kirkman suspects the birds are moving higher to find a more suitable climate. For now, he says birds are still flourishing on Whiteface, but he's concerned about species such as the Bicknell's thrush that require high altitudes.
One of the things that people have been worried about is if birds that were already at the top are being pushed uphill, that there's no place for them to go, and they'll actually just become pinched off the top of the mountain.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Toys R Us has announced it will nullify severance plans for 33,000 employees who are losing their jobs as the company closes its doors in the coming months. The company filed for bankruptcy last September. Toys R Us is the latest company to be driven to bankruptcy after being acquired by private equity firms. Toys R Us was acquired in 2005 by the firms Bain Capital, KKR, and Vornado, who saddled the company with more than $5 billion in debt and more than $400 million in yearly interest payments. According to the Washington Post, the firms paid themselves $475 million in advisory fees and other payments, including tens of millions of dollars in bonuses to top executives, only days before Toys R Us went into bankruptcy. Writing about the bankruptcy in April, New Jersey Congressman Bill Pascrell said, "In practice, these deals favor the equity tycoons who help themselves to enormous bonuses. Simultaneously, their new possessions are left holding debt they cannot pay. An otter cracks open a clam before discarding the shell, and so do these firms. The shell is the American worker." Over 40% of the retail chains who filed for bankruptcy between 2015 and 2017 were owned by private equity firms. Toys R Us employees met with lawmakers in New Jersey on Friday to push for their severance pay. Workers also called for new regulations on leverage buyouts and windfall taxes that would prevent private equity firms from running a business into the ground and then walking away with huge sums of money.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture. Today's episode features a listening session on the reorganization of the Department of the Interior, which has proven problematic for many Native Americans. Modernization of the Columbia River Treaty with Canada, but with the exclusion of local tribes, and Native American journalist Jenny Monet is cleared of trespassing charges.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A listening session on plans to reorganize the Department of the Interior, which oversees Indian Affairs and Indian Education, was held Sunday in Kansas City, Missouri, at the National Congress of American Indians Mid-Year Conference. As Rhonda Lavaldo reports, tribal leaders are troubled by the way it's being handled.
John Tasuda, the Department of Interior's Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs, started off with explaining the reorganization by executive order by President Donald Trump in order to improve efficiency and effectiveness.
Secretary, I've had the privilege of traveling with him around a good part of the country in the last few months, and he's been very clear on his view on this, in that this decision is ultimately up to you, to the tribes. If you want to participate in this department-wide reorganization, that's up to you. If you don't, don't. But our hope is that we will be able to convince you that there is value there for you to do that.
Jefferson Keel, president of NCAI, asked if the decision was already made.
If you go back to the historic way that things have happened to Indian country over the years, from the founding of this country, is that Indian country has accepted by default the organization that we see today. The manner in which it's been undertaken in the past historically has been, this is the decision, this is how we're going to do it, it's up to you whether you like it or not. And what you just said was, it's going to happen whether Indian country decides to be a part of it or not is up to us.
Aaron Payment talked about the process of involving tribal nations.
There's no Indian voice, and no offense, but there's nothing. And so you're doing a really good job of trying to put lipstick on this pig earlier by using arguments and justifications and trying to backfill all of this with all of this talk of efficiencies and creating direct paths and all of that. But it's being met in Indian country, and I don't know how you can convey this very clearly to the secretary that my answer, and I think the answer from the Anishinaabe country, is Kaween. No.
Eight more listening sessions are scheduled across Indian country. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
The U.S. and Canada opened talks last week to modernize the 1964 Columbia River Treaty, which governs management of the river. Yet, as Emily Schwing reports, there's still no formal tribal representation.
When the State Department announced it would formally open renegotiations with Canada, the Confederated Tribes of the Colville voiced disappointment at the lack of tribal representation on the negotiating team. There are 15 tribes on the U.S. side of the Columbia River Basin. Three Canadian First Nations say they've also been excluded from formal negotiations. Republican Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers has been pushing for renegotiations for at least 4 years. She says consultation with tribes has been adequate.
I'm comfortable with who is at the negotiating table. It's those that are actually managing the river system itself, and they long have been the lead negotiators.
The U.S. negotiating team is led by the State Department and includes representatives from the Bonneville Power Administration and three other federal agencies. The next round of discussions is scheduled to take place in mid-August. I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
A North Dakota judge Friday cleared Native American journalist Jenny Monet of trespassing charges filed against her during coverage of the Dakota Access Pipeline in 2017. Judge Thomas Schneider said prosecutors failed to prove she knowingly trespassed on private land owned by the company building the pipeline. Monet told the Bismarck Tribune the not guilty verdict is a great day for journalism. She reported for several organizations, including National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Stephanie Feldstein, author of The Animal Lover's Guide to Changing the World. At 6, it's Labor Radio. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, the Portland area and east of the Cascades and Hood River will be partly cloudy, with a low in the upper 40s followed by partly cloudy skies and a high in the mid-70s. Today in history, in the year 1989, the Tiananmen Square riots were violently ended. The official death toll was 241, but now it's suspected to be over 1,000. The quote of the day is from Ma Jian. To become self-aware, people must be allowed to hear a plurality of opinions and then make up their own minds. They must be allowed to say, write, and publish whatever they want. Freedom of expression is the most basic but fundamental right. Without it, human beings are reduced to automatons.
On today's Tron Report, we hear about the upcoming Alaska elections where both sides of the aisle are wooing the native vote.
Alaska politics got a lot more complicated Friday, and the Democrats, Republicans, and Independents are all looking for the native vote. This is Trahent Reports. Former Alaska Senator Mark Begich jumped into the race for the governor of Alaska Friday. That means there will be a three-way contest this fall with a Democrat and a Republican challenging independent governor Bill Walker. Begich picked as his running mate Deborah Call, Denina, a member of the Nick Tribal Council. She is the sixth Native American to run for the office of lieutenant governor and will compete with Alaska's current office holder, Byron Malott. Malott, Tlingit, is also a Democrat. Alaska now has three Native candidates running for lieutenant governor, including Edgar Blatchford, a professor at the University of Alaska. Begich's entry into the race will make a complicated November. A three-way race means it's unlikely that any candidate will receive support from a majority of the state's voters. 4 years ago, Malott was the Democratic Party's nominee for governor, but he stepped down from that call in order to run with Walker on a fusion ticket. The Walker-Malott ticket then narrowly defeated the incumbent governor, Sean Parnell, by little more than 2 percentage points. A court ruled earlier this year that Walker could seek the Democratic nomination as an independent. But Begich's entry into the campaign puts an end to that idea. Walker and Malott will go straight to the November ballot as independents, provided that they get enough signatures from voters to qualify. Walker told the Associated Press that he has no interest in a destructive primary. Walker told the Anchorage Daily News that independent voters are the majority. 4 years ago, he said he was a little-known candidate who defeated the incumbent. Now I'm sitting here as an incumbent, Walker said. We climbed that mountain before, and I'm comfortable with where we are. Mark Begich served in the U.S. Senate until he was defeated by Senator Dan Sullivan in 2014. He has also been the mayor of Anchorage and is the son of the late U.S. Representative Nick Begich Sr., who disappeared during a campaign flight in 1972. Deborah Call has been an Alaska Native leader in many capacities. She has been president of the Nick Tribal Council with a membership of more than 4,000 people. She was also president and CEO of the Calista Heritage Foundation and is the former vice president of operations and human resources at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. Call has an MBA from Washington State University. Professor Edgar Blatchford also filed for the office on Friday, so there are now three Democrats running for the same office. This is an extraordinary year for Native Americans and the office of Lieutenant Governor. Minnesota, like Alaska, has three candidates, and another candidate in Oklahoma brings the number to seven. What an extraordinary time. I'm Mark Trahant.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Current Cast is a daily production that highlights one of our most precious resources, fresh water. On today's episode, Floating Urban Gardens.
Floating Urban Gardens on this Current Cast. For many years, Chicago's rivers have been used for transportation and commerce.
But now they should be used for habitat and interaction.
That's Zachary D'Amato of the nonprofit Urban Rivers. His group is installing man-made floating wetlands in the Chicago River. They're essentially rafts of plants attached to the river wall. In addition to adding a splash of color, the gardens provide habitat for wildlife and absorb pollutants from the water.
The plants, they grow off all the nutrients that are existing in the water. So we add no fertilizer to any of the plants we put in.
They're helping transform a drab urban river into a cleaner, more beautiful waterway. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
And now it's time for Labor History in Two with host Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1946. That was the day the Detroit Free Press reported that a grand jury had been convened to investigate the severe beatings of four Briggs UAW Local 212 officers over the previous 15 months. Recording Secretary Ken Morris had been the latest victim. He was brutally beaten May 31st behind his home. Arthur Vega, leader of Local 212's Flying Squadron, was viciously attacked by thugs in March of 1945 and suffered a broken arm and other injuries. Next, Local 212 Sergeant-at-Arms Roy Snowden was clubbed on two separate occasions, suffering permanent injuries. Then, in October 1945, Janora Dollinger, heroine of the 1937 Flint sit-down strike and founder of the Women's Emergency Brigades, was beaten so severely as she lay sleeping that she was hospitalized in critical condition for weeks. Since her Flint years, Dollinger had become active with Local 212. She served as a leading member on the union committee established to investigate the earlier beatings. Both the local and the international led investigations into the beatings and offered sizable rewards. Union militants noted the beatings benefited the company to be sure. Briggs had fired all four victims at one point or another for union activity. Strike preparations had been underway when Morris's wife found him with his head cracked open. The UAW waited for the grand jury's findings. By year's end, another Local 212 shop steward had also been beaten. By 1951, union officials demanded a second grand jury investigation. They accused Briggs of awarding a lucrative scrap contract to a local mob boss, Carl Renda, in exchange for anti-union thuggery. No charges were ever brought against the company, which insisted the violence stemmed from intra-union disputes.
Today, the Supreme Court sided with a Colorado baker who made regional and then national headlines in 2012 for refusing to bake a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. The original case, Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission No. 16111, began when David Mullins and Charlie Craig visited Jack Phillips Bakery. Mullins and Craig were going to be married in Massachusetts and were looking for a cake for the ceremony. Phillips turned them down, saying he would not use his talents to support same-sex marriage as it conflicted with his religion. Mullins and Craig said that statement humiliated them, and they filed a complaint with the Colorado Civil Rights Division that said Phillips had violated state law barring discrimination based on sexual orientation. Mullins and Craig won before the Colorado Civil Rights Commission and in the state courts, but the Colorado State of Appeals ruled that Phillips' free speech rights had not been violated because the couple had not discussed the cake's design before Phillips turned them down. The court then added that people seeing the cake would not clearly comprehend Phillips to be making a statement, and that Phillips could say what he wanted about same-sex marriage and other environments. Justice Anthony M. Kennedy, writing for the majority in the 7-2 decision, relied on rigid grounds, saying that a state commission had violated the Constitution's protection of religious freedom in ruling against Phillips, who refused to bake the wedding cake for the gay couple. Kennedy wrote, "The neutral and respectful consideration to which Phillips was entitled was compromised here. The Civil Rights Commission's treatment of this case has some elements of a clear and impermissible hostility toward the sincere religious beliefs that motivated his objection." Although the state Supreme Court or the federal Supreme Court's decision appears as a win for those arguing for more protections on religious freedom, it has strengthened protections for gay rights and left a window of possibility open that other cases raising similar issues from different demographics could be decided differently. Kennedy elaborated by saying, "The outcome of cases like this and other circumstances must await further elaboration in the courts, all in the context of recognizing that these disputes must be resolved with tolerance, without undue respect to sincere religious beliefs, and without subjecting gay persons to indignities when they seek goods and services in an open market."
Over the weekend, U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon attempted to visit a detention center for immigrant children in Texas. Merkley intended to shed light on a new zero-tolerance policy from the Trump administration. On April 6th, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced the new immigration policy aimed at those crossing the border illegally. Sessions announced that anyone who enters the country illegally will be met with, quote, "the full prosecutorial powers of the Department of Justice," end quote. The policy stipulates that any person crossing the border illegally, even those credibly seeking asylum, will be criminally charged regardless of if they have no criminal record. This change means that parents bringing children to the U.S. who don't cross the border through a sanctioned port of entry can be arrested. Upon their arrest, they are separated from their children. This policy is meant to deter immigrants, even those seeking asylum, from attempting to cross the border. Senator Merkley tried to visit Casa Padre, a detention center in Brownsville, Texas, run by the nonprofit Southwest Key Program. In a Facebook Live video posted by Senator Merkley, he is denied access to the detention center. The windows to the center are blacked out, and Merkley is denied entry as he attempts to observe the children's living conditions. The program supervisor, Juan Sanchez, who Merkley wanted to speak with, appears briefly at the end of the video. Sanchez came outside of the building to greet police officers who had been called on Merkley. Sanchez refused to give a statement, and Merkley complied with Sanchez's request that he leave the property. This follows recent reports of 1,500 immigrant children, quote, "lost by the U.S. government after being assigned to live with a sponsor."
In recent days, countless news stories have surfaced concerning 1,500 child immigrants taken from their parents only to be lost by the U.S. government. In an AP fact check published this morning, that story has been clarified. Multiple photos circulating that show children in cages have been used to exemplify how Trump's immigration policy is affecting migrant children. The photos were originally taken in Arizona in 2014 during the Obama administration. Additionally, the 1,500 migrant children unaccounted for were not separated from their parents at the border. The 1,500 children arrived at the border without their parents and were assigned to sponsors in the U.S. Stephen Wagner of the Department of Health and Human Services claims the majority of children are assigned to sponsors who are close to the child, like a parent or relative. Wagner disclosed that some of the children are assigned to, quote, "other than close relatives or non-relatives," end quote. Senator Rob Portman of Ohio chairs the Senate Homeland Security Subcommittee to which Wagner discloses information. Portman knows this government issue well. 2 years ago, his committee published a report demonstrating that HHS officials had released 8 children to human traffickers in Ohio. The children were forced by the traffickers to work on an egg farm. Between October and December of 2017, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is a program under the HHS, attempted to contact 7,635 children who had arrived at the border unaccompanied and had been assigned to sponsors. Of those children, 6,075 still live with their sponsors, 28 children have run away, and 52 have begun living with a non-sponsor. According to Mr. Wagner, 1,475 of those children couldn't be located, quote, with certainty. The ORR claims they could not account for most of those children because many sponsors did not return the program's calls. Trump and Obama have similar records in this area. In 2016, under Obama, 85% of children were accounted for by HHS, while under Trump, 86% were accounted for. The lack of certainty surrounding the whereabouts of these children has reignited concerns that the government does not enforce proper safeguards against unaccompanied children being turned over unknowingly to human traffickers. Multiple immigration advocates have criticized HHS for doing too little in following up with children and their sponsors. More than a year after the Department of Homeland Security and HHS were supposed to establish procedures for dealing with and ensuring safety for unaccompanied migrant children, the procedures are yet to be completed.
The Public News Service is a member-supported organization that aims to keep the news media honest. On today's roundup, one of Trump's lawyers claims he could shoot someone without consequence as the president. LGBT detainees are 90% more likely to be assaulted in ICE detention, and the EPA takes action on formaldehyde in wood.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, June the 4th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. It turns out Trump could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue without fear of indictment, according to one of his lawyers. Also on our Monday rundown, LGBT detainees are 97 times more likely to face sexual assault in ICE detention. Plus, the EPA takes action to protect consumers from formaldehyde on manufactured wood. First, our top story is a candidate. Donald Trump bragged that he could shoot someone on New York's Fifth Avenue and not lose any support. Now the Huffington Post reports the president's lawyer says Trump could shoot the FBI director in the Oval Office and still not be prosecuted for it. Giuliani told the Huffington Post Sunday, in no case can he be subpoenaed or indicted, claiming a president's constitutional powers are that broad. Giuliani said impeachment was the initial remedy for a president's illegal behavior, even in the extreme hypothetical case of Trump having shot the former FBI director. New data shows lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender immigrants are 97 times more likely to face sexual assault in federal detention centers than the general population. Catherine Davis Young reports the analysis for the Center for American Progress shows detention centers are especially dangerous for transgender immigrants.
In addition to cases of sexual assault, it reports cases of transgender women being held in facilities for men, or sometimes in solitary confinement. In response to recent written questions from Congresswoman Kathleen Rice on Immigration and Customs Enforcement's handling of LGBT detainees, the agency replied it was, quote, committed to faithfully executing our duty to enforce immigration laws, end quote. But Sherita Gruberg with the Center for American Progress fears the Department of Homeland Security hasn't been taking appropriate steps to protect LGBT immigrants.
DHS is supposed to do a risk classification assessment on people during intake. And for people who are particularly vulnerable to sexual abuse, that's supposed to factor in from the first step of when they're deciding, do we detain this person or not, to where exactly do we detain this individual.
The Trump administration has vowed to tighten policies at the U.S.-Mexico border for reasons of national security. In April, President Donald Trump issued a memorandum asking immigration enforcement not to release detainees as they await immigration hearings. But Gruberg says the increasing federal pressure to keep more people in custody is putting LGBT immigrants in situations where they're more likely to face assault.
Women's rights activists and some medical experts say the Trump administration's proposed gag rule on reproductive health could increase unintended pregnancies and abortions. Ross Brown reports on a new Trump administration rule that makes it illegal for doctors, nurses, hospitals, and community health centers that participate in the Title X program to tell patients how they can safely and legally access abortion.
Title X was established in 1970 to provide affordable birth control and reproductive health care to America's low-income population. Jennifer Conte, a doctor with Stanford University and a fellow with Physicians for Reproductive Health, says the federal government is incentivizing clinics to stop offering abortion if they also want to provide birth control to the nation's poorest residents.
This is a gag rule. As an abortion provider, if I can talk about abortion, but I can't talk about where or how to obtain one, that essentially I am being gagged in that I am being forced to lie to my patients by omission.
So far, 13 governors across the country have signed a letter to the Secretary of Health and Human Services opposing the rule. A poll by Heart Research Associates shows that 73% of Americans also oppose the rule.
By one estimate, unsafe abortion takes the lives of about 47,000 women worldwide every year. And a new poll shows that Mainers are not in sync with Governor Paula Page when it comes to the environment. Linda Barr has our report.
Most voters want to replace him with a candidate who supports land conservation and clean energy when they vote in the primary on June 12th. Pete Dittesheim, advocacy director with the National Resources Council of Maine, points to efforts by LePage to drive a wedge between Maine voters and the environment. He says LePage has had a pretty anti-environmental record.
He has not supported land conservation. He's opposed Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument. He's supported offshore oil drilling. He's been critical of land conservation and clean energy and has attacked solar. But Maine people are in a very different place.
Statewide, the poll shows Mainers strongly support energy efficiency and clean energy policies to address the problem.
And finally, Eric Tegenhoff reports a new rule put in place by the Environmental Protection Agency this month will protect consumers from formaldehyde in wood products.
Formaldehyde is used to bind wood in products such as cabinets, flooring, and even RV paneling. However, excessive use of the product can hurt people's health. While the EPA created tougher standards in 2016, agency head Scott Pruitt delayed their implementation. Earth Justice challenged that decision, and in March, a judge ordered enforcement of those rules by June 1st. Patty Goldman, Northwest Managing Attorney at Earth Justice, calls the decision a major win for consumers, especially given the harm formaldehyde can do.
It's a respiratory irritant. It's linked with leukemia and other cancers. It exacerbates childhood asthma. So it's really a good thing that we will be protected from excessive formaldehyde emissions.
In 2010, the Congress passed bipartisan legislation adopting California's stance on tougher standards for formaldehyde. That 2010 statute eventually led to tougher regulations in 2016 and their enforcement this month. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for newsin' and cruisin' with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is C.J. Fritz, Anthony Mascaro, Ken Jones, and Sam Bowman. The producer is Grace Ann Smith. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelis Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk radio show covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener commentary. At 9 on Alternative Radio, journalist and activist Arun Gupta discusses policing, property, and evangelism. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and at 11, Stage and Studio talks with performing literary and media artists from the Northwest. And at 11:30, Art Focus welcomes Auggen's gallery Bob Koch to discuss the detailed artwork of Indian painter A.J. Garg. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Good night, Ken.
Good night, Grace Ann. Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
On today's KBOO News In Depth, we're happy to welcome Stephanie Feldstein, author of the new book, The Animal Lover's Guide to Changing the World, Practical Advice and Everyday Actions for a More Sustainable, Humane, and Compassionate Planet. Stephanie's the Population and Sustainability Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. She heads a national program there addressing the connection between human population growth, overconsumption, and wildlife extinction crisis. Stephanie created the Stake Take Extinction Off Your Plate campaign, and her work has been featured in the Huffington Post, NPR, Salon, The Guardian, and The Washington Post. Stephanie, thanks very much for joining us at KBOO today.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Stephanie, as mentioned in the intro, you're the Population and Sustainability Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. First, can you tell us a little bit about the center and your role there?
Absolutely. The Center for Biological Diversity has been around for over 25 years, and we're a national wildlife organization that works to protect endangered species and wild places through advocacy, through using the law, through science, and through creative media. And we have teams of amazing advocates and organizers and lawyers who work on issues related to climate change, to protect our public lands, to protect our oceans. And my area of work is really looking at what is the human impact on wildlife and wild places, and how do we start to address that?
And what a great person to write that book then. The new book, again, called The Animal Lover's Guide to Changing the World, Practical Advice, Everyday Actions for a More Sustainable, Humane, and Compassionate Planet. It's due out tomorrow, so this is very timely. What were your reasons for writing the book?
Well, we live in a world of animal lovers. It only takes a few minutes on social media to really see that. And in all of my years of working for animals at the Center for Biological Diversity, and even going back to college when I worked part-time in the local animal shelter, I've come across so many people who love animals and want to make the world a better place for them, but really weren't sure where to start or whether their efforts will make a difference. So I wanted to write a book that would give people the tools to start taking action today, even if it starts with something small, as well as giving the tools to build up to bigger actions. And also, of course, I wrote the book because I love animals. I mean, this was the book that I wish I'd had when I first started to realize just how much of an impact my actions and decisions had on the world.
Now, Stephanie, you divide the book into three parts. It's get political, get wild, and get personal. I'd like to talk a little bit about each. You start off the first section with this great quote from Winnie the Pooh. Some people talk to animals, not many people listen, though. That's the problem. What would we hear if we were listening?
Right now, probably a lot of calls for help. You know, there's a lot. Every single animal on the planet is affected in one way or another by our laws and by our society. But animals don't get a vote. They don't get a voice in our politics at all. And so we have to be their voice. And so that section really focuses on all of the different ways, not just, you know, in political action in terms of voting, but also on how to make your voice heard in your community, to businesses that you frequent, as well as in your day-to-day conversations, and how even the way that we talk about animals can influence the way that they're treated. And I think the animals that we share the world with want to be seen, want to understand that we are all sharing this one planet. And when we make choices, when we consume things, that has an impact on the other species around us.
Which leads us right into the second section here, Get Wild. You go into the environmental impact of our choices and what that's doing to wildlife. What are some of the more simple changes each of us can make to protect wildlife and their habitat?
Well, one of the biggest ones that I think the theme throughout the book goes back to that point of consumption, is we overconsume so much. And, you know, obviously there are things that we need and that we use every day, but there are also so many small decisions that we make and impulse buys And when we're choosing between different products, that may not really be as necessary. And this section of the book, it's by no means a call to go back to, you know, a Spartan lifestyle or give everything up and go live in a cave, which bats probably wouldn't be too happy about anyways. But it's really a call for consciousness and for us to live with intention and to think about the fact that everything that we buy comes at a cost to wildlife. And so when we are out there purchasing things and making choices, whether, you know, that's about what we eat or whether it's about the things that we're buying for our home, that we really take a second to step back and think about, is this the best choice? And is this something that we really need, or is there a better alternative?
And of course, there's a lot more detail in the book. So this is kind of a very cursory glance of what's in each section. I want to get to the book's third and final section, too. It's called Get Personal. You start off with another great quote, this one from J.W. Stevens. The quote is, be the person your dog thinks you are. What are some of the things we can do to be that person?
Well, one of the things that I really focus on, there's a whole chapter in there that I really enjoyed writing called The Ambassador of Dogville. And that's in really thinking about how our interactions with our dogs and making sure we all want everybody to understand that, you know, my dog is the best dog in the world. Everybody should know that and love them just as much. But we have a responsibility to them to help people love them, to make sure that they are well-trained and well-managed and that we're caring for them and that we're their voice in our community. And that's how we can help build more dog-friendly communities. We're very lucky, of course, in the Portland area that it's such a dog-friendly place. But there are a lot of other communities where that's at risk, where certain dog breeds are banned or where laws are much more restrictive and there aren't as many services for pets. And so by taking care of your dog and by properly training them and really bragging about them, letting other people see how wonderful they are, you can really start to help build up a community of dog lovers.
I was going to kind of amend that, too, as a person who owns a cat and is a big cat lover, and I know you own both dogs and cats. Be the person your cat thinks you are. I wonder exactly. I wonder how that would look. Do you have, and want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's interesting. Some of that ties back into the Get Wild section as well, because, of course, there's a lot of conflict between outdoor cats and wildlife. And one of the ways that we can be responsible to both our cats and our wild neighbors is by keeping cats indoors. Or if you take your cat outside, have a catio for them that's an enclosed area, or have them out on a leash to prevent any unnecessary wildlife deaths. Cats do love to kill wild animals as much as we might not want to believe that about our feline house.
No, it's part of their instincts.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, so a lot of the things about, you know, being a good ambassador for your dog also relate to your cat, is making sure that you are a responsible cat owner, both in the way that you're treating them day to day in your house, making sure that they're well loved and well cared for, but also in the way that they interact with the outside world.
And Stephanie, where can our listeners find out more about your work and especially the new book?
The new book will be on sale everywhere tomorrow, everywhere that books are sold. And people can order signed copies from Powell's or come to the event next week on June 14th. I'll be at Powell's at the Cedar Hills Crossing location in Beaverton. You can also find out more on my website at stephaniefeldstein.com. That's where all the information is about the book itself. And then, of course, with my work with Center for Biological Diversity, our website there is biologicaldiversity.org.
Well, Stephanie, is one animal lover to another, thanks very much for joining us on KBOO today.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking with Stephanie Feldstein, the Population and Sustainability Director at the Center for Biological Diversity and author of the new book, which goes on sale tomorrow, The Animal Lover's Guide to Changing the World, Practical Advice and Everyday Actions for a More Sustainable, Humane, and Compassionate Planet. You can learn more about Stephanie's work and her book at stephaniefeldstein.com. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring an archive contractor for 40 hours a week for $20 an hour. This is a contract position that will last from July through December of 2018. The archive contractor will steward the KBOO archival assets in all forms. They will work with historical KBOO content in many audio formats, as well as the Resource Space Archival Database, documents of KBOO history, and KBOO staff and volunteers. Please send in a resume, cover letter, and answer the question, Why is KBOO important? To Dell at KBOO.org. That's DEL at KBOO.org. More information about responsibilities and position requirements can be found at KBOO.FM.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Don't worry. I won't hurt you. I only want you to have some fun.
Dearly beloved,
oh yeah, come ride and dance with Diablo all over Portland as we celebrate Prince's birthday on Thursday, June 7th at 8 p.m. with a mobile bicycle dance party. We'll be rocking Pedalpalooza and dropping the Prince jams all night long with frequent dance stops. Once again, that's Prince's birthday bike ride celebration, Thursday, June 7th at 8 p.m. More information on the KBOO website under Community Events.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Holla! Good evening, and welcome to the Oregon Coalition of Black Trade Unionists segment of Labor Radio on KBOO. Please excuse me just a moment. And highlighting the works of the working class, by the working class, for the working class, here on KBOO 90.7 FM, where the heart of the community comes alive 7 days a week. KBOO